good to be here. My name is Russell. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group, and we are in the middle of a step series, step seven, one of my favorite steps. And I'm happy to be here, and I'm glad you all are here, and I appreciate being in this room. It's a wonderful room. It's been here. It's one of the oldest rooms, if not, I think it is the oldest room in Miami-Dade that's been in the same location. And I've been sober a little over 30 years, and in this program a little bit over 30 years. And I remember going to this room 30 years ago, and it hasn't changed much, you know. And that's always a good thing, to, you know, everything sort of changes, you know. And you can't base your spirituality and your spiritual condition on something that's going to rust or decay, or here today and gone tomorrow. Any group, you know, people die, they fade away. Even sponsors, even good sponsors, you know, I've had three sponsors, and they were all wonderful, wonderful men, and I learned from all of them. The two of them are dead. Died sober, but, you know, cancer got them, and, you know, they're no longer around. And now I have a sponsor who's got 57 years, and he's a wonderful guy. But my sobriety isn't based on a chip, not based on a sponsor. I remember when I picked up my first medallion, my one-year medallion. I guess it was whatever it was, 29 years ago, my one-year medallion, and I had that little medallion thing, that little metal thing. You know, and some people like pierce it and put it on a necklace and, you know, jewelry. And I had this little thing, and I was so proud, and I got it, and I took it home, and I put it in my, I put it somewhere, wherever I put it. And I woke up the next morning, I couldn't find it. And I was frantic. I was running all over the house and going crazy, because I just knew that if I didn't find that medallion, I was going to drink, or some sort of crazy, you know, crazy thought like that. And then I realized I had one of those inspirational thoughts that God gives you, that my sobriety was not based on a piece of metal. That if my sobriety was based on a piece of metal or a person or a thing, you know, I'm out the window. You know, that my sobriety, what I had been through during that year, and what I had turned to during that year, and what had helped me that year, was not something I saw, not something I could touch. It was God. It was something else. And that was just a symbol. That little metal thing was just a symbol. And the truth of the matter is, and this is just me, it doesn't have to be you, I pick up those medallions. I never really carry them around. I don't know where they are. 5 seconds after I pick them up, I don't know where they are. You know, and it's not that it ain't a big deal, and it's a wonderful deal, and it's important, but that's not where my sobriety is. That's not where the deal is that I'm looking to. I'm always looking up there. I'm looking at Him. Because it said in my book, it says, see to it that your relationship with Him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. Because I read the book. It took me many, many years to really understand what they were talking about, because I fought this thing, because I'm a good alcoholic, and I'm prideful, and I want to do it my way, and they couldn't possibly mean what they actually said they mean. That would be crazy. Turn your will and your life over to God. I mean, yeah, what do you do when you have real problems, you know? And so I want to read a few things. You know, we can argue in AA about a lot of things. I'm not here to argue. I'm just here to give my experience. You know, you can argue about religion, you can argue about doctrine, you can argue about God, you can argue about everything, but I'm going to tell you something. Bill Wilson used to say, an experience beats any argument. And my first sponsor used to say, when a man with experience meets a man with money, the man with experience will walk away with the money, and the man with the money will have walked away with an experience. And I can tell you one thing, I'm a lawyer, I've been a lawyer for many years, and if you go into court and you got a serious case and you got a choice of somebody who knows the law and somebody who knows the judge, you better go with the guy who knows the judge. I can tell you that right now. You go for that old guy who's been around the block a few times, you know? We want young doctors and old lawyers. Be with people. It's really, my old grandfather used to say, it's not what you know, son, it's who you know. And, you know, you want to know the deal. You know, it says you can't manage your own life, even though we spend years and years, even after coming in here, trying to manage our lives. It says no human power can relieve our alcoholism. He says only God could and would if He was sought, so seek Him. Seek God. Seek Him. That's the deal. So I want to read a few things from the big book. I got a poem. I got two poems, actually. You know, I got a poem. We'll see. I'll read that in a little while. But I want to read a couple things, and then we're going to talk about step seven. And I really want to get into step seven. You know, step seven is about humility. I don't know anything about humility, but I'll tell you something. I'm an expert on arrogance. I'm an expert in arrogance. I am one arrogant guy. I was going to give my speech on humility, but I never do it to a group this small. You know what I mean? Reserved for larger audiences, you know? Let me read a couple things out of the big book. And you know, this is like connecting the dots. This is like, you ever see, anybody ever see real, you know, it's like I'm here to, look, if I say anything to piss you off, good. You know, I'm here to really bring comfort to the afflicted, if you're, and to afflict the comfortable, to disturb the comfortable. So nothing would please me more than to see you walking out of here hating me. Because then I won, right? I'm an alcoholic. I know what that's all about. I've walked around with people on my mind, old-timers on my mind, people I wanted to beat up and kill and hurt and report to New York and everything like that. And I know who wins that argument. And they're walking out happy as clams, and I'm thinking about them for 3 weeks. I know who loses that argument. I know who wins that argument. I know who's in charge. Nothing would please me more than have you guys just thinking about how much you hate me for the next 3 weeks because of something I said. Because then you're like my little puppet. You know, I've got you. I've got control over you, you know. You're mine, you know. Until you figure out what the deal is, you know. But in any event. Well, you know what they say? Whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause. That's our spiritual axiom. That's the spiritual axiom. That's a spiritual axiom. Whenever you're disturbed, no matter what the cause. No matter what the cause, there's something wrong with you. That's why in Sermon on the Mount he said, you know, don't look at your brother. Don't look at the speck in your brother's eyes. Look at the beam in your eyes. Look what's going on with you. Look at yourself. You're the one who has the problem. That's why the Apostle Paul said, I've learned the secret. I've learned how to be content in all things. I've been rich. I've been poor. I've been in jail. I've been out of jail. It doesn't matter to me. You know, that's why the people that I look up to in AA, the minors, the people I look up to, never seem to be rattled. The ones that I really respect are people that not only talk the talk, they can walk the walk. You never see them mad. You never see them upset. You know, they may have good times. They may have bad times. They may have all sorts of things happening to them. But you want to see them, they look exactly the same. Calm. You know, you're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. They're not up and down and complaining and whining or anything like that. I love that line, one of the last lines that the carpenter said when he left the plane. He says, in this world you will have problems, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. What does that mean to overcome the world? What does that mean what does it mean to be content in all things? What would you give not to think the thoughts you think and feel the feelings you have? You know, when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the guy said to me, he says, you know, you never have to drink again if you don't want to. And you never have to feel the way you feel now if you don't want to. And I wanted both those deals. I wanted not to drink again, and I never wanted to feel the way I feel. I never wanted to think the thoughts I thought, because my thoughts were bad thoughts about myself and other people, and I didn't know how to get rid of them. I didn't know how to get rid of them. I had them for 10, 15, 20 years after coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you know what it's like to have people on your mind and things and stuff and being anxious and feeling sorry for yourself and being mad and all that crap that goes along with having an alcoholic mind, that committee they talk about, 50,000 voices in your head and they're all talking about you and it's all bad stuff about you and other people and complaining and whining and life is tough and you don't know what to do or how to get rid of it and you're not drinking and you know there's something wrong with you and you don't know what it is and you know it can't be drinking because you haven't had a drink in 18 months or 2 years or 3 years, but you're going nuts anyway and you feel like killing yourself or blowing your brains out or you don't know what the bottom line or who's going to help you. You know, and it is an alcohol. It's something called alcoholism. And so it says right here in our book, it says, so our troubles we think are basically of our own making, though we usually don't think so. Selfishness and self-centeredness. That is the basis of our trouble. Constantly thinking about ourselves, focusing on ourselves. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, and self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of others and they retaliate. It says, above everything, if you're an alcoholic and you're here, above everything, we alcoholics must get rid of selfishness. Sure, you can stop drinking. You know, I've been around here 30 years plus. I've rarely, if ever, I can't even remember somebody who's come to AA who hasn't been able to stop drinking. The worst wino in the world I've seen come to AA and pick up a white chip, and the next thing he's picking up a green chip, and then red, and they stop drinking. They stop drinking for 30 days, they stop drinking for 60 days, they stop drinking for 90 days, then they're out the door again. They stop drinking for 5 years, then they're out the door again. They stop drinking for 10 years, then they're out the door again. They stop drinking, but then they start again. Why do they start again? Why do they start again? What is that all about? You know, and that's the whole thing, because it's all about, because you can get rid of the drinking, but how do you get rid of the selfishness and self-centeredness? That's the root of, how do you get rid of the thinking about yourself? How do you get rid of, they can't do that to me? Who do they think they are? How do you get rid of, they don't know who they're screwing with? How do you get rid of chasing the guy down who just gave you the finger or trying to cut him off, you know, when you're 10 years sober or 15 years sober? How do you get rid of 3 o'clock in the morning not being able to go to sleep because you got notice from the IRS or something or anything? It doesn't matter, the least little thing, and you're on a tizzy, you don't know what to do or who to talk to. How do you get rid of the shame and all the crap that goes along with the thinking and living in this world? Because you have, I don't know if you've noticed this, no matter how sober you are, no matter how good you are, no matter what you do, the world keeps on, it doesn't really take notice of it. You ever notice it? They don't really care if you're sober. The traffic's still there. You know what happened to me the other day? You're not going to believe what happened to me the other day. I got an FPNL bill. I got one last month. I took care of the one last month. What's going on now? I walked into my kitchen this morning. You know what was there? Dishes. What's that all about? It's like over and over again. It never stops. The world never stops. You know, it's always the same thing. People doing the same thing. People acting up. People acting poorly. You turn on the TV. You watch the news. The same crap over and over and over again. Sometimes the faces change. Sometimes they don't. How do you escape the craziness? It says right here. It says, so our trouble we think are basically of our own making. It says, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness. We don't even know what that looks like. You know, we read the words, it sounds like, what does selfishness look like? It's hard to tell yourself. I mean, it's like a fish, you know, you're telling a fish he's swimming in water. What's water? What's it? Selfish. When you're selfish, when all you are is selfish. I'm not selfish. This is what I used to say to my sponsor. He'd say, you're this, you're angry. He says, this is just the way I am. This is just the way I am. You know, like that, like, this is just the way I am. And I can't change because this is the way I am. Well, you better change. Your best thinking on your best day got you in here. You better learn how to change. And you can change, but here's the horrible thing is you're powerless to change on your own. You're powerless to change on your own. You know, that's what the big book, if the big book is about anything, it's the fact that you can't change. That you're powerless not only to stop drinking, but that's the least of it. You're powerless to change. You have no power. That's why they wrote this book. That's why they have this chapter to the agnostics. They don't have a chapter to the believers. The believers, that's the rest of the chapters. The chapter of the Gnostics says it's a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of life would get us where we got to go. We would have been sober and fine a long time ago. But the problem is no thinking, no figuring out, no intellectual way of doing things could ever get us where we got to go. We had to have a power. We were powerless. We had to find a power that was greater than ourselves, could restore us to sanity and remove this thing. And so we wrote a book and we're going to talk about God. And that's where we get all pissed off because we don't want to talk about God. And it says, God could and would if he was sought. We read it today. God could and would if he were sought. You know, it's not like I have 5% of the power and he has 95%. He has all the power. I have no power. And in the promises, the things that we read, you know, you're going to know a new freedom, a new happiness. No matter how far down the scale you go, you'll see where your experience can help others. Fear of people, economic insecurity will leave you. You'll begin to see how, you know, things that used to baffle you, all of a sudden be clear what to do. And you'll realize that God is doing for you. God is doing for you what you could not do for yourself. If you could do it for yourself, it ain't no big deal. You know, it's when things happen to you and you change and it's a miracle and you can't explain it. And you can explain it because you know God is doing it, because the Holy Spirit's doing it for you. Okay, here's the deal. It says right here, above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must or it kills us. We're not even talking bruising, you know, or a bad night. We must or it kills us. And then you know what it says right after that? You ready for this? God makes that possible. Now, listen, I don't know what fellowship you're in, you know. Hey, listen, I go to church. I love my church. But just because somebody's sitting in church, that doesn't necessarily mean to me that they're a Christian, you know. I mean, I don't judge people, but I know just because I'm sitting in my car, that my garage doesn't mean I'm a Buick. You know, just because you're here, I don't know what fellowship you're in. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous. That means we agree on this book. This book is very clear. It's very straightforward. Just because we don't want to hear the truth of this book and we get pissed off at it and we want to change it, doesn't change the words. Doesn't change the English language. It says God makes that possible. It doesn't say God makes that possible in some cases and others he doesn't. It doesn't say God makes that possible. It says God makes that possible. It says, many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we had liked to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness as much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. We had to have God's help. Now, if you disagree with that, I'm not going to get mad at you. I'm not upset with you, but at least be honest with yourself. Say, I just disagree with the program. You know, don't go around telling people as you're flopping around and doing all sorts of things that you tried the program and it didn't work. Tell them the truth. Tell them you went in there, you weren't willing to try the program 100%. You weren't willing and you wound up on your ass. Just tell them that. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that here and after in this drama of life, and this is important as far as the seventh step is concerned, and I'm going to tie this in. In this drama of life, God was going to be our director. God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple, except for this crowd. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arc through which we pass through freedom. This is the keystone. He's the main guy. He's the guy. We're just following his directions. And as if you didn't quite get it, they say the same thing over and over and over again in the book, a million different ways. This book is just saying the same thing over and over again, a million different ways. You can even flip to the back of the book. Go to the last page of the book, and this is what it says on the last page of the book. Still, you would say, but I will not have the benefit of contact with you who write this book. We cannot be sure. God will determine that, so you must always remember that your real reliance is on him. Same thing, different way. Always remember your reliance is upon him. Must be total reliance upon God. He will show you how to create the fellowship of Christ. He's even going to show you who you hang around with and who you don't hang around with. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. You know, we talked about this last week. You read this book, you think it's these people. You think it's Bill Wilson. You think it's Dr. Bob. After they wrote this book, they said, listen, we don't know crap. This is what they said. We know only a little. Listen, here's what they say. They say, God, here it is again, God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation. Don't ask me. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. And you have people running around here saying he talks too much about God or don't talk about God. Don't listen to those people. You understand? Don't listen to those people. They're going to kill you. You're not going to get this deal. They're scared that everybody in AA will start doing what they say to do in AA, and then they might have to do it or find another group. They're not trying to help you. They're those people that are out there in the bars drinking, that are going to slip, that are trying to hurt you. And the only reason they're mad about the God thing is because it scares them, because they don't want to go there. And this is, in my opinion, because I'm reading this out of the book. People come to me and says, oh, I like what you said. I like when you said that, you mean what I read out of the book? Says, yeah, but it's the way you read it, you know? you mean like with emphasis, so you can't ignore it. You know, yeah, that kind of thing, you know? When Sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. An employer, you know what an employer is? Do you know how many guys I sponsor in AA who have flushed their wives and kids down the toilet, flush their entire self-respect down the toilet because of drinking, and they're called, told to go to meetings, and they make the excuse of not going to a meeting or not doing something spiritual because they say my boss wants me to work late, or they don't, or they give up their family, or they give up their children because their boss wants them to do something. They're so scared of their boss. Oh, if we were only so scared of God, like we're scared of our bosses, because the only thing a boss can do is take away a job. You know, not lack of listening to your real employer will take away your life. If we only knew what the real deal was. You know how many guys are drinking out there that have lost everything because they're listening to their boss? They will prostitute themselves. They will do anything. They will flush their wives and kids down the tubes for their boss for a job, but not for God. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful. He provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. If we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life as we felt new power flow in. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. We were reborn. What's that like, to lose fear of today and tomorrow and the hereafter? We were now at step 3. Many of us said to our Maker, as we understand him, God, I offer myself to thee. to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power. Bear witness to people that your power works, that I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. You ever read this step, this prayer? It's not about you. It's about him. We thought well before taking this step. We thought well before taking this step, making sure that we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. I don't know about you, but that word utterly is like a serious word. Utterly to him. You go on to step five, to the fifth chapter. I mean the sixth chapter, it says, because that's what it's all about. It's about clearing away the records, doing everything so we have a relationship with him, so the power can flow in and we can become like him in his image, in his likeness, grow in his image. Not that we're ever going to get perfect. Having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. In our path, the obstacles to be having a new relationship with him. We have admitted certain defects, and we have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We have put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. Now these are about to be cast out. You know, this is a step meeting, right? I'm going to talk about the step. I'm going to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous, what this is really about. Let's go to the 12 and 12. Then all of a sudden, last week we were talking about step 6. It says this. This is the step that separates the men from the boys, so declares well-loved clergyman, who happens to be one of A's greatest friends. He goes on to explain that any person capable of enough willingness and honesty to try repeatedly step 6 on all his faults without any reservations whatsoever, that's step 6 is we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Becoming right with God, righteous with God, right standing with God, has indeed come a long way spiritually and is therefore entitled to be called a man who is sincerely trying to grow in the image and likeness of his own Creator. That's their terminology. That's their standard. If you're doing this thing, you're trying to grow in the image and likeness of your own Creator. Now, if you want to believe your Creator is, you know, like the doorknob, that's fine with me. You can take that as far as you want to go. And if that'll work for you, I'll meet you back here in 10 years. We'll see how that works. I'm sure the doorknobs have standards, you know, values and stuff like that. You know, and, you know, when you get to a point in your life, you're trying to figure out some real tough things and where you should go and what you should do, you can say, well, what would the doorknob do? You can figure that out. What would the doorknob do, you know? You can figure that out. You know, this is all about seeking him. This is all about seeking him. I feel sorry for somebody who's got 20, 25 years and 30 years who still doesn't have any semblance of an idea of who he is or what he is or what his values are all about. I feel sorry for that man. You know, he's trying to shortcut the shortcut. You wind up nowhere. So let me read a couple of things. Let me get to my poem. A couple of poems. And I'm going to read a couple of things, you know. I got one. So this has a little bit to do with the seventh step. And then we're going to go to the 12 and 12 and the seventh step. This is, I haven't read this one before. I won't read this one. I've read it. One poem is enough for you guys. So one. Okay. Robert Frost. Good poem. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood. And sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler. Long I stood and looked down one as far as I could to where it bent in the undergrowth. Then I took the other, as just as fair, and having perhaps the better claim, because it was grassy and wanted wear, though as for that, the passing there had worn them really pretty much about the same. And both that morning equally lay, in leaves no step had trodden, black. Oh, I kept the first for another day, yet knowing how way leads to way, I doubted if I should ever come back. I shall be telling this with a sigh, somewhere ages and ages hence, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And that has made all the difference. So every one of us, you know, this ain't a dress rehearsal. This isn't like we rewind it and you get to do it over again. This is it. This is the deal. You don't want to be like that other thing I read, which I'm not going to read now, like the guy in the glass where you get to the end of your life and say, man, I could have had a V8. I screwed the whole thing. Why? Because I was worried whether they were going to laugh at me. You don't want to get to that deal. You want to take the right road. You want to take the right road, you know? You know, it says right here, and I don't even know this, in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, in talking about this stuff, it says, you know, I don't know if you know this, Alcoholics Anonymous was started in 1935. The big book was written in 1939. This thing we call our basic text was written in 1939. Now listen, A started in 1935, big book written in 1939. What's the difference there? Any mathematicians here? 4 years. They write this book that we all sort of look at. It's our basic text. Here's what the book says. We read it at every meeting. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. So you say, well, I don't want to fail. I want to experience much of heaven and be rocketed to the fourth dimension of existence, of which I have not even dreamed. I want to have the same experience they had. So what do? Do I read the big book? Well, there's nothing wrong. You should read the big book, but they didn't read the big book. They told you what they did as far as the steps are concerned, but that was after they wrote them in the big book. What did they actually do? This is Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers. This tells you what they did the first 4 years. This is what it says. It says, Dr. Bob, this is on page 96, so you can check it out. Make sure I'm not just throwing this at you. Dr. Bob, noting that there was no 12 steps at the time, no big book, our stories didn't amount to anything to speak of. Later he said they were convinced that the answer to their problems was in the good book. That's the Bible. You can get mad at that. You can get mad at the facts. You know, you're entitled to your opinion, you're just not entitled to your facts. The good book. To some of us older ones, the parts that we found absolutely essential were the Sermon on the Mount. That's chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Matthew. The 13th chapter of 1 Corinthians and the book of James. I'm not going to, you know, I'm just telling you, that's what they found essential. You know, I don't know if you know this, but in chapter 7 of Matthew, in the Sermon on the Mount, it says, talking about them two roads, it says, enter through the narrow gate. See, this thing's been around for a long time. It's been around much longer than 1935, 1939. It's been around for centuries. Enter through the narrow gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many enter through it, but small is the gate and narrow the road that leads to life, and only a few find it. My sponsor, when I first came in here, said to me, you know, Russ, many are called, but few are chosen. The statistics in AA now, and I'll be happy to send them to you, just send me your email address, are that 0.5% of the people that come in here stay sober for more than 20 years. 1 out of 200. 1 out of 200 stay sober for more than 20 years. No, you don't have to believe me. I've been hanging around here 30 years. And this AA's been around for 75 years, and you want to know something or more, and I'll tell you something. I don't see about 20, 30, 40 people here with 20 years or more. You know, most people drink again, commit suicide, do all sorts of crazy things. You know, and few find it. So now we got this 12, you know, here's the deal. I'm in a meeting one day, I've talked about some of this stuff before. I'm at a meeting one day. By the way, let me just read the seventh step. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Now, I don't know about you, but I don't think I know how to do humble. Now, listen, I know all about humiliation. I don't know much about humble. I mean, I don't know. You wake up in the morning, and say, oh, I think I'll be humble today, you know? How do you do humble? I don't want to, you know, it's like I've got the prize here for Jesse. Jesse, you win the humility prize. As soon as he comes up here to grab it, we take it away from him. You know, I mean, how do you do humble? It says humility. It says right here, it says, since this step so specifically concerns itself humility, we should pause here to consider what humility is and what the practice of it can mean to us. What does humility mean to me as an alcoholic? What does it mean to me? You know, one of the definitions of humility that I found in the big book is it says to clearly be able to see who and what you are. To clearly be able to see who and what you are. Indeed, the attainment of greater humility is the foundation principle of AA's 12 steps. For without some degree of humility, no alcoholic can stay sober at all. Nearly all AAs have found, too, that unless they develop much more of this precious quality than may be required just for sobriety, they still haven't much chance of becoming truly happy. truly happy. You know, in the first chapter of the Big Book, one of the things it says, unless and until an alcoholic accepts his alcoholism and all its consequences, whatever that is, his devastating weakness, they call it, accepts his devastating weaknesses, his sobriety will be precarious, and of true happiness, he'll find none at all. I mean, is that your idea of sobriety? I mean, listen, you know, it's wonderful when people don't drink. It's great when people don't drink. You could have everything go wrong with you during the day, and if you don't drink, you're a success. But I'll tell you, I mean, if your idea of sobriety is living for the next 20, 30 years, a thumb-sucking crybaby, whining, crying, gossiping about people, talking about people behind their back, always thinking bad thoughts about yourself and other people, comparing your insides to other people's outsides, worrying about, always constantly filled with worry and remorse. That's not my idea. That's not what I want. So what's this humility thing, and how do you get it? So I'm sitting in the 12, I'm sitting in the keynote group one day, and I've got 3 months sobriety. I've told this story before, but, you know, it's an experience I had, and it's worthwhile telling. And I've got 3 months. I'm whatever a three-month person is. We probably have some three-month people here, 9-8 people here. And I'm not drinking, and I'm sitting there with my sponsor, and a guy named Al Kennedy is up talking like I'm talking to you right now. And he's sharing, you know, something, I guess, the way I'm sharing with you right now. And the group is like the size of this group right here. And I'm watching this guy. My eyes are fixed on this guy because he's just uplifting people, and he's giving them hope, and he's encouraging them, and he's like a man's man. You know what he's like? He's like the guy I always wanted to be. You know, like I was brought up on like John Wayne movies and stuff like that. I'm looking at him, I'm saying, I wish I could hang out with this guy. You know how it says in the Big Book I just read, it'll say, many of you will say, I don't have the opportunity to hang out with you. God will know that for sure. I was looking at him and says, man, I'd love to hang out with that guy. There's something about it. There's a strength. This guy had an inner strength, but he wasn't arrogant. You know what I mean? He was strong, but he wasn't like a bully. You know, he was kind, but he wasn't weak. There was just something about him. You knew that this was a guy you wanted to hang out with. This is a guy that you want for a sponsor or a mentor. This is a guy that you know would always be solid and be there for you, who could help you. You know what I mean? There was something about this guy. And he finished the meeting, and he finished talking. And I hadn't had a drink in 90 days. I was working the program. And he left. I was working the program, and he left. And I turned to my sponsor, and I said, boy, he was great. I really liked him. And my sponsor said, you know, he's dying. And I said, no, I'm talking about the guy who chaired the meeting, that guy Al Kennedy. He says, he's dying. I said, the guy who was chairing, he didn't say anything about dying. Or he says, I know. He says, he didn't say anything about dying, you know. And I don't know about you, but I mean, if I had a hangnail, that was good for 3 weeks of meetings, you know what I mean? You know, I was constantly whining about something. He didn't say anything. He says, Russell, he's dying of cancer. He's got 3 months to live. Now I got to tell you something, and I swear on my life, this guy not only didn't mention dying, he didn't even look like he was dying. It was like it didn't even, whatever was going on with him, he was on a different. He was, I don't know what sobriety meant to me, but I know whatever he had, whatever he had going for him, I didn't even have close to the deal he had going. But by looking at him, by seeing a man who was apparently dying of cancer and had 2 months to live and could be like that and have that effect, I knew that I haven't even tapped the surface of this deal. I haven't even laid hold of the surface of the power of God that could try, because listen, do you remember before you came into AA, does anybody remember having a situation? I looked the guy in the eye and I said, I need help. This is what I said. I said, I need help. I can't stop drinking. Now, I don't know what kind of alcoholism you had, but I had the kind of alcoholism where I couldn't stop drinking. Am I the only one in here? Did anybody have my form of alcoholism where you couldn't stop drinking? I couldn't even consider stopping drinking. I couldn't envision a life without drinking. I'm telling you that the reason I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous and the only reason I went to Alcoholics Anonymous is because I couldn't stop drinking, which is probably, considering the name, Alcoholics Anonymous, a good reason to go. When you think about it, I mean, you know, it beats the American Legion and things like that. That's probably why we have it in the name, you know what I mean? Alcoholics Anonymous, dead giveaway, something to do with drinking. So listen, here's the deal. If you understand what it's like to have a life where you can't stop drinking. And you finally come to the conclusion that your life is unmanageable, you're falling apart, because you can't stop drinking. And if you can recall coming into a room, not knowing crap, and all of a sudden having a day happen where all of a sudden you're not drinking. Anybody remember that, where you couldn't stop drinking? That happens pretty quick, doesn't it? That happens like that. I mean, really, it really happens like that. I mean, for some people, the obsession hangs on. But one day, you can't stop drinking. The next day, and you don't even know what happens. You don't even do anything. You don't even do anything except you submit yourself. You pick up a lousy white chip. You say, I need help. I can't stop drinking. And all of a sudden, the next day, you're not drinking. And then you're thinking about drinking, and you're worried about the obsession. And then a week down the road or 2 weeks down the road, you're not even thinking about drinking. And the obsession's been removed. And something that's been plaguing you for years that you never thought you'd get rid of, it's like not even a problem. And you're like blown away. Anybody remember being blown away by that? And now you're 2, 3, 4, 5 years down the road and you don't even think about that. Really, you don't even think about it because you take it for granted. I'm not saying you take it for granted in a bad way or you take five. It's like you just don't think about drinking. Drinking's not a part of your deal. You're not going to drink today. You're going to go to a meeting and it's not even a big deal. But try to remember what a big deal it was to one day not being able to stop drinking, and all of a sudden you could stop drinking. All of a sudden you're not drinking. Now I want you to think about something. Anybody here ever worry about money? You know, you probably think, man, I'll never stop worrying about money. I'll never stop worrying about money. Try to figure out whether it's possible to live your whole life worried about money and what's going to happen to you. And one day, that same power that took away the drink, you never worry about money anymore. Ever. And it has nothing to do with your bank account. You may have no money, you just don't worry about it. Ever worry about people and what they think about you? What they say about you? Whether they're talking about you behind your back? Can't stop that? You figure you're always going to be that way? That's the way it's always going to be? Try to think what happens with a life where all of a sudden, you know, the same power that took away the booze, one day you wake up and you're no longer worried about what people think about you or what they're doing. You never worry about it again. You're never concerned about yourself. Try to think about the thing that you worry about or think about the most, that bothers you the most in your life that you can't get rid of. And think about one day you wake up and it's never a part of your life anymore because you're free. You're free. Because the same power that took away the booze, you know, all of a sudden you're free of that deal. Think of that kind of freedom, that kind of new freedom, that kind of new happiness. Think about what it's like to worry about whether you're going to die or not, or whether you're going to live or not. And then one day you wake up and you're not worried about that anymore. You're not worried about dying. And you know it's impossible not to be that way. It's impossible to be like Al Kennedy, but one day you're not worried about dying. As a matter of fact, it's okay, up or down, it doesn't matter. Because you got better things on your mind, you know, because you're more concerned about other people and helping them out. Try to think about that deal. Try to think about having that power available to you and having that life available to you and going through your life and not drinking and never tapping into that power and getting that stuff happening to you. Just living your whole life worried about that other stuff and never getting that other stuff. Try to think about a time when I walked in to see a doctor and he said, listen, you got cancer, Russell, and we're going to have to operate on you because it's all through your neck, you see? And then if we operate, you know, we take it out, you know, we may be able to get out, we may not be able to get it out, then we're going to have to give you, you know, radiation therapy for 3 or 4 months. You know what I mean? You got a wife, you got a bunch of kids, you know? And the doc says that to you and says, that's the deal. And I said, it's all right. Don't matter. Everything's cool. And you walk out and say, thank you, Lord. Thank you, Lord, for that deal. You know, I know you're with me up or down. It ain't going to matter. I'm going to do that deal. And all of a sudden, it's like Al Kennedy time. And you know what happened? Try to think about what it's like to live a life without fear. And I'm not saying it's perfect. I'm not saying I never get anxious or hell, I'll bring my wife in here. She'll tell you the real story, you know. You bring me down there, I'll tell the Mays what's really going on, you know. Well, she's an Al-Anon. Our Ladies of Perpetual Revenge, you know. She does an Al-Anon 10-step. When I'm wrong, she promptly admits it, you know. But you don't want to miss that deal. So how does that deal happen? How does that deal happen? How do we get a new perspective on stuff like that? Through 1,000 forms. You know what the 7th step says? Through 1,000 forms of, I want to read it exactly, 1,000, how do we get a new perspective? It says this, For us, the process of getting a new perspective was unbelievably painful. That's not just painful. That's like unbelievably painful. It talks about how our whole life as alcoholics, we're running from the pain. We're running from the anguish. We're worrying from anything. It says, and here, we don't run from the pain. We embrace the suffering. We embrace the pain. How do you do that? A mere person can't do that. You can only do that if you have a relationship with him. Because if you have a relationship with him and you know he's there and you have faith, this is you know what this is? You know what it says in AA? This is a deal for faith that works. Faith doesn't mean anything if it doesn't work. You know how faith works? Faith works. You can tell when faith works. It works when you have cancer. It works when you're broke. It works when people are dying. It works when times are rough. It works when times are good. It says, for us, the gain of new perspective was unbelievably painful. It's only by repeated humiliations that we were forced to learn something about humility. It was only at the end of a long road marked by successive defeats and humiliations and the final crushing of our self-sufficiency, that we began to feel humility as something more than a condition of groveling despair. Every newcomer in Alcoholics Anonymous is told and soon realizes for himself that his humble admission of powerlessness over alcohol is his first step towards liberation from his paralyzing grip. It goes on to talk about I love this part where it says, I might as well go into it. It says, certainly no alcoholic and surely no member of AA wants to deprecate material achievement. In other words, we don't want to put down things or money or cars or a job. We don't want to put that down. So you feel pretty good. They're not going to put that down. Then they pull the rug out from under you. They say, nor do we enter in debate with men who still so passionately cling to belief that to satisfy our basic natural desires is the main object of life. Well, that's good because that's my main object in life, to satisfy my basic natural desires. But then it says, but we are sure that no class of people in the world ever made a worse mess of trying to live by this formula than alcoholics. It just didn't work for us. Then it says the bottom line. For thousands of years, we have been demanding more than our share of security, prestige, and romance. Security, prestige, and romance. Lifetime Channel. I got a wife. I got three daughters. I got a wife and three daughters. They worship at the tube of Lifetime Channel. I know what's going on. They're watching some guy, you know, hooking up with some other gal's mother's cousin's squirrel. I don't know. Something's happening. For thousands of years, we have been demanding more than our share of security, prestige, and romance. What's this all about? It's girls wanting guys. It's guys wanting girls. It's guys wanting jobs. It's girls wanting... It's money. It's romance. It's all that running around. What are people worried? I never see people in A sucking themselves saying, oh, I'm worried about my relationship with God. Oh, I stay up all night worrying about the Lord, you know what I mean? I'm worried about my car, I'm worried about my cell phone, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about that. It's all worry and aggravation over crap. Crap. That means nothing. And you think the world helps you? You know what's going on in the world? You go out there, you see the billboards, you know, gals, guys, sex, and all that sort of stuff trying to sell you more of that stuff. You go to the movies, it's all about that stuff. You go to TV, it's all about that stuff. You know everybody successful is doing well, has that stuff. They all have that stuff. And you know if you talk about God, they all laugh at you. So, you know, you go after that stuff, and you get more miserable, more miserable, more miserable. When we were frustrated, even hard, we drank for oblivion. Never were there enough of what we thought we wanted. To all these strivings, so many of them well-intentioned, our gripping handicap had been our lack of humility. We lacked the perspective to see that character building and spiritual values had to come first. It goes on to even talk about people who believe in God, who don't disbelieve in God, but you want to know something? They don't rely on him. They rely on themselves. They say they believe in God. Maybe they go to church or something like that or read the Bible. It doesn't matter. But they're really looking to themselves. It says in here, we learn the value of suffering. What does it mean to learn the value of suffering? What does it mean? You know, I was telling somebody the other day, I'm not sure they understood, but I just said it. I said, you know something? When bad is good, you never have bad. I don't even know how to explain that. And you may have to go through it a million times. Hey, are you suffering now? Are you going through some bad stuff? Hey, it's going to happen. It's your 40-year in the desert time. You know, the Israelites came out of Israel. There was like a two-week march over to, came out of Egypt. There was like a two-week march over to Israel. They could have walked right into Israel. Two-week march. 40 years in the desert. 40 years, an entire generation died off. Like two guys got in that started with the mark. Two guys. But you want to know something? Because they walked out of Egypt with slave mentalities. And the guys that walked into Israel were kick-ass guys, and they didn't have slave mentalities anymore. They had desert rat mentalities. They were ready to, you know, kick ass and take numbers. You know what I mean? They were ready. You know what I mean? There was a whole change of the whole deal. Do you want to have a slave mentality, an alcoholic mentality, a bondage mentality, where you're bonded on it, where the most important thing in your life is whether you can have a cell phone or whether you have a car? And it's not that you can't have these things. It's that you don't worship these things. Or do you want to be focused on Him? You know, and I'll tell you, when you focus on Him, I'm going to tell you something. You may have bad things happen to you, but you want to know something, it's never that bad. I can't even explain it to you. You just have to. It's like trying to explain to an alcoholic who can't stop drinking that you haven't had a drink in 10 years or 5 years or 5 months. What do they say to you? How did you do it? And you try to explain it. They don't understand what you're talking about. You say, they say, you got one to drink? He says, no, I haven't had a drink in a year. You say, how do you do that? I say, well, I go to meetings. You can't even explain it to them. I'm sorry. I can't even believe how anybody gets it. You know, but we get it. We somehow transmit it, and they get it, and they come in here, and then they learn. How do you explain to people that you can live a life where stuff can happen around you? Like the Apostle Paul, I've learned to be contented. You can have traffic problems. You can have money problems. You can have all sorts of problems, and it doesn't affect you. Because it just happens and you're just there, but you feel okay. Because inside your circumstances, your feelings about how you are not controlled by your outward circumstances, no matter how bad they look. You know, I didn't understand when Al Kennedy was dying of cancer, and he got up there and he was doing that meeting, he was helping people, and he walked out the door, and my sponsor said, he's dying. I didn't understand that. I couldn't wrap my mind around that. I couldn't in a million years understand how somebody could do that. And one day I woke up, knew the new freedom and happiness, and I was at that deal. And how do I explain that to you except to tell you that kind of thing exists? That there are people in their lives that their whole day is not, you know, they're not sitting around saying, oh, you wouldn't believe what happened to me today. Oh, I got to, you know, get the, their whole life is not, you know, that stuff. They've got freedom. And it's because of going through the suffering. Listen, when you go through the suffering enough, and you finally, through the suffering, have to turn your life over to Him and find out that it all works out, and it all works out even better than it ever worked out, and you're doing better, and it doesn't matter what you look. All of a sudden, you wake up one day and say, hey, what's the big deal? He's protecting me no matter what. And then the next time it happens, you don't even see it. And then it happens over and over, but you got to go through the deal. You got to go through the suffering. You know, you go through the suffering. That's what the seventh step is all about. And the reason, one of the reasons I like it is because I don't think it ever ends. It doesn't end for me. I'm not saying, hey, I'm finally through with the seventh step and that's it. There's more suffering down the road. But you want to know something? Now I see that it's for my good. It's for my greater good. You know, the Apostle Paul, one of the great lines he has, is he says, I was given this satanic thorn. We don't know what it was. Hey, it could have been, you know, some good church people think it's like nearsightedness. I can understand that. You don't want to think that he's got like alcoholism or anything, you know. But all we know is he says it was this horrible thing he got. This guy wrote 13 books of the Old Testament, New Testament. He said, I got a horrible, horrible deal. It was satanic and it was killing me. And I asked God to remove it. He says, God, take this away from me. And he said, this is what God told him. He says, I will not take it from you. Because to keep you from becoming conceited, to keep you from becoming thinking like you have the power or you're conceited, he says, I'm going to keep this on you because my strength will be sufficient for you to get through this thing one day at a time. My strength will be sufficient. Put on the full armor of God. And he says, because when you're weak, I'm strong. You guys didn't walk into Alcoholics Anonymous saying I need help and stop drinking because you were strong. You walked in at your weakest. You know, the problem with alcoholics is we walk in, you know, unemployable, and 2 months later we're underpaid. We get strong again. Now, I don't know, I'm going to end it this way. I don't know what humility is. I really don't. And I'm not going to say, gee, I know what it is. But I was talking to Jesse, one of the guys who I drove over here. And I know this. Every day I wake up, and one of the things that runs through my life, and I can't explain it to you, and you may never understand it, and maybe you'll understand it as I say it, is the one thing I know about myself is that I'm nothing. I'm nothing. And I don't say that. You don't have to say, gee, why is he putting himself down? I'm not putting myself down. I don't brag it. I am. You know what I can tell you about? I said, I am nothing. I used to be something. I used to be the greatest, the best, the most incredible, and I couldn't pay my child support and I was a drunk. And now I'm a nothing, and I've been married for 30 years. I got 4 children that love me and 6 grandchildren that are crazy about me, and I'm nothing. They don't think I'm nothing. They think I'm something. They don't know I'm nothing, and he's everything. And I know that. I know that I'm nothing, and he's everything. So I'm always looking to him and thanking him more than I know that I'm sitting here talking to you. I feel stronger about that. And I don't know what that deal is, but I think it has something to do with clearly seeing who and what I am and where the power is. So I just pray one day you get to that deal. Thank you very much. God bless you. Okay.